The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you. Thanks for coming early in the morning after probably partying. So let's just get to it. Marx, as you probably have heard, very famously or infamously said that the philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world, but the point is to change it. Now, did he mean that we should try to change the world instead of interpreting it? And if so, why did he go on to spend so much time developing a particular method for interpreting the world, one that was deeply informed by philosophy and which requires the use of abstract reasoning, among other things? And why did so many well-known revolutionary leaders after him spend so much time not only engaging in philosophical disputes, but often doing so in very urgent moments, including right in the middle of an unfolding revolution when counter-revolutionary violence was knocking at the door? After all, Marx and Engels, also who I'm going to be, I'm actually going to be talking more about Engels than Marx in this talk, also say in the Communist Manifesto that the capitalist world, where all that is solid melts into air, where nothing that is familiar ever stays that way, where crises suddenly pitch workers into destitute poverty, is one in which people are compelled to face with sober senses their real conditions of life and their relations with their kind. In other words, to ask questions and reject, you know, comforting but insufficient answers, to try to grasp the reality beyond the appearances, to work out a conception of why things are the way they are and how they can be changed. Capitalism itself compels people not only to organize and revolt, but I would say to do so philosophically. In fact, the history of mass movements and revolutions, you see masses of people gaining intellectual self-confidence, realizing that they actually are capable of not only developing a theoretical understanding of things, but one they haven't been taught, one that is sufficiently complex to make sense of a complicated and dynamic world, right? The self-emancipation of the working class is an intellectual as well as a material process, I think. Now, this doesn't mean you have to be a trained philosopher to engage in a demonstration, organize a strike, or even lead a revolution. Actually, I could tell you such training might take you a step or two backwards, but never mind. But exploitation and oppression under capitalism are maintained not only through coercion and force, but through the dissemination of ideology, right? You've heard it, that capitalism is natural, we're the best of all realistically possible worlds, all attempts to radically change things just make them worse, and so forth. So in other words, philosophical outlooks and philosophies, they're weaponized against us under capitalism, and so we need to be able to both critique them and develop our own in order to cohere and sustain an ongoing struggle against it and to win people with wide-ranging doubts and questions to our side. Now, Marxism is a unified outlook that includes economic, political, and historical analysis, so it's a philosophy in this broader sense, but it's driven by and held together by a particular philosophical method without which, as Trotsky says, it is a clock without a spring. This method has come to be called dialectical materialism. Before going into it, I want to make a few preliminary points about it. Dialectical materialism is a method. It's meant to be used, not just contemplated. A lot of the stuff that really helps me understand what it is has been in writing that's not actually about it, but which uses it to make sense of something else, like the need for a revolutionary party and the struggle for socialism. Since it's meant to be used, it can be used poorly, right? As Trotsky says, it's not a magic master key for all questions, you know, that relieves you of the need to examine the concrete particulars of any given situation. I'm going to come back to that because I think it's very important. Related to that, it's a living theory that's meant to be applied in new and often unprecedented situations. It's meant to be applied intelligently and not mechanically, and it doesn't apply in exactly the same way or with the same degree of complexity to everything. Further, it's more approachable than you might think, and it's in fact used unconsciously by a lot of people who might not know or use the name. Lastly, it's not an entirely unique theory. In a brand new book, I don't have it in front of me, but it's in the book room by Wayne called A Marxist Education. He shows that it's very similar to methods in Egyptian, Chinese, and also Aztec philosophy. With that in mind, I think the best place to begin is with something Engels says in the book Anti-During, which is, I think it's out of print. Anyway, it's on the flyer there. He says, when we reflect on nature, or the history of human society, or our own intellectual activity, we see an endless maze of relations and interactions in which nothing remains what, where, and as it was, but everything moves, changes, comes into being, and passes out of existence. So dialectic seeks to understand reality, including human society, in its motion, development, and transformation, as a process in which everything that exists has come to be by way of prior transformations, in which nothing is as it always has been, and in which nothing will come to be except what can be produced by transformations of current reality. Engels contrasts this to what he, following Hegel before him, calls the metaphysical approach, which means a bunch of different things, but here it just means like undialectical. Basically, it means, as he says, the habit of observing natural objects and natural processes in their isolation, detached from each other and the whole vast interconnection of things, not in their motion but at rest, not as essentially changing but as fixed constants, not in their life but in their death. In being materialist, Marxist dialectic sets out to understand nature or material reality on its own terms, as something that unfolds and transforms by way of its own internal tensions and contradictions, and not by way of being acted upon by some external, you know, supernatural or divine agent. So I'd like to first go into materialism a little bit further, because the opposition between materialism and idealism is extremely old. But also because the fact that Marxism is materialist, I think, has its own political relevance and distinguishes it from other approaches, from liberalism to social democracy to anarchism. Materialism holds that the material world exists independently of our minds, that is, it has existed far longer than we have, that we and our ideas are a product of it and are fundamentally shaped by it. Matter can exist without the mind. Mind cannot exist without matter. And it holds that we can achieve real, if limited, knowledge of the material world in practice, right? One of the interesting things Engels points out in this book on Feuerbach, that's on your sheet there, is the fact that we've figured out how to produce a lot of the organic compounds that are found in nature confirms materialism more than any abstract argument possibly could. Idealism, by contrast, holds that ideas are more fundamental than matter, that all we really know are our own ideas and impressions, not the material world, and that ideas are what drive and explain change. Now, unlike some forms of materialism that deny, like, the causal power of ideas, Marxist materialism holds that ideas can and do shape material reality. But, as Engels often puts it, in the last analysis, matter is more fundamental. In other words, ideas are important, but they don't do anything by themselves. Rather, what happens is that ideas that are first of all located in the brains of flesh and blood people and are shaped by the material conditions in which those people live are carried out in the material world by material means, whether through, you know, bodily action, through instruments of the state, by being spread by the printing press or social media or a bullhorn at a demonstration. Those are all material things. Likewise, ideas that can't be carried out in the world, either at all or under the given material conditions, will not succeed in shaping material reality. In other words, ideas can shape reality, but only in a way that confirms materialism. You could say that materialism is philosophy from below, right? From the bottom up. In practice, thank you. copyright me, right? Sorry. In practice, it means appreciating the fact that you always act in a context that just is what it is, whether you like it or don't, and regardless of what your ideas or preferences may be. It means that if you want to change the world in whatever way, you want to know not just what you're in favor of, but what it's going to take to get there from where you are. Which paths are possible and not possible, which are promising and which are dead ends, which obstacles are likely to be thrown in your way in the process of trying to achieve them, and supposing that they are achieved, what it's going to take to preserve and build on them. You want to really know these things as well as you can, not just have strong opinions about them. Right? You want to have some idea of where the levers of transformation really materially are and not be so entitled as to think you could just go in and shape the world to your liking without understanding how it works first. As Michael Lowy explains in his book about Marx, it was Marx's own frustrations with a German bourgeoisie that was timid and complacent in the face of feudal reaction that sent him searching for the class that could serve as a material force in liberating society, finding it in the rising proletarian movement in Paris in the 1840s. It was the existence of this movement that led him to develop his theory of socialism as proletarian self-emancipation and to break with the idea of an elite intellectual class bringing socialist ideas down to a passive suffering people. At the same time, this is what I want to emphasize here, he was able to see the rising proletariat as the answer because he was a materialist, because he was looking for an actual agent of real change and was impatient with the utopian schemes of disengaged philosophers who, as he put it, think they have all the solutions in their writing desks, and that the stupid world only has to open its mouth for the roast pigeons of absolute knowledge to fly into it. That's a badass quote, right? Earlier socialists saw themselves as the enlightened few whose ideas would lead the unthinking masses towards a better world. For them, right, you have, and there's a philosophical theory behind this, right, that you have thought over here, and material realities over there. And even though there's a different as they can be, ideas are somehow supposed to get a foothold in the material world to produce change, right? It's a real puzzle. With Marx, this puzzle doesn't arise because for him, material reality includes people, living people coming to sharper consciousness of themselves and the world in the process of changing both. Social revolution for Marx is a process of mass transformation in which a mass movement with little practical or theoretical self-confidence, with limited goals, is transformed in struggle into one that is self-reliant and revolutionary. In other words, it's a process in which something is transformed into its opposite through its own activity. This is a process that can't be understood or even seen, I think, looking at things as isolated and motionless. It can only be understood with dialectical laws and concepts. So let's look into these. So dialectics, again, starts from the fact that the world is in a constant process of motion, interaction, and change. It's meant to help us get a handle on how things change in order to put us in a better position to intervene and change things effectively ourselves. Now, the idea that change is the only constant seems really obvious when you think about it, but I think it's really noteworthy how seldom, under capitalism, we actually think about it. To paraphrase Engels, it's an obvious fact concealed by an overgrowth of ideology. There are a lot of those, I think, right? Like our interdependence on one another, the fact that we require one another in order to live, right? It always seems to come as a surprise when you talk about that. Yes, it's as obvious as it could be, right? And I think it's not difficult to see why. Once you accept that our world is one in which things constantly come into being and pass away, you're not that far from wondering how capitalism will pass away or be transformed into something else. I don't think you need me to tell you that this is something the capitalist ruling class would prefer that you not think about. Right? For example, John Molyneux writes, "As a university teacher, I had a half-serious rule in class discussions that students were not allowed to say that things would always be so. Interestingly, they found this very hard to observe. They kept wanting to say things like, well, there will always be a certain amount of racism, you know, or women's oppression or poverty, for the simple reason that they had been fed these messages explicitly or implicitly since birth." Again, I think it's clear that philosophy, in the sense of a persistent critical thinking about fundamentals, is something we need and something the ruling class knows we need in order to liberate ourselves and therefore does its very best to get us to ignore and denigrate and make fun of and roll our eyes at. Sorry, I'm a little defensive about this because I'm a philosopher. As I want to show here, like, a dialectics is actually not that complicated, right? There are philosophical theories, I promise you, that are a lot more complicated and have a lot less of a foothold in reality. Once you get the hang of it, you see these laws in operation all over the place, you can't stop seeing examples, and the question becomes, what if anything isn't dialectical, right? At the same time, you can just go around and mention dialectics. I'm sorry, but even here, right, in the conference full of Marxists, and a lot of times people just like kind of run the other way, or they just avoid it, they drop it like a hot potato, oh, it's over my head. And that's a real paradox. Why is that? There probably isn't just one simple answer, but I think it can't be an accident that Trotsky also pointed out from his time in America that there's this deep-rooted prejudice against theory, the lack of confidence, right? Not ability, but confidence so many have to understand and use it is especially prevalent here in the most powerful capitalist nation in history. So we just keep that in mind. I don't mean to scold or anything like that. When you say things like, "Oh, that's over my head," or even worse, when you try to suggest it's over other people's heads, you're kind of doing the ruling class's ideological dirty work. You should stop doing it. So the world is one of change, but also continuity. Right? Capitalism is an extremely dynamic system, but its dynamism helps preserve the conditions of capital accumulation. Your body is in a constant process of changing at the cellular level, but this is what keeps you alive. In April 1917, the Bolshevik Party had to take a very sharp turn that alienated even some of its leaders, but in order to remain a revolutionary party. So even in these simple descriptions, we see contradictions. Things stay the same, but only as moments in a longer process of change, and often can only stay the same by changing. Again, when we examine things at rest and lifeless alongside each other, we may see differences, but not contradictions. But as Engels says, the situation is quite different when we consider things in their motion, change, their life, their reciprocal influence on one another. Then we become involved in contradictions. Motion itself is a contradiction. because it consists in a body being in a given place and also not in it, right? The creation and resolution of this contradiction is, that's what motion is. It's in and not in a given place because it's in a process of passing through it, right? And in case you think this is just wordplay, this contradiction is the reason that calculus was created, for example, to be able to represent a moving object's speed at a given moment in time. When considered at a particular moment, it's not moving at all. That's all I remember from calculus. But it's a cool point, right? Engels continues, if motion contains a contradiction, this is even more true of organic life and development. A living thing is at each moment itself and yet something else, right? As it ages, as it takes in and excretes matter. It's a little gross. Life is a contradiction that originates and resolves itself, and as soon as this contradiction ceases, life too comes to an end. So dialectics involves motion through contradiction, right? Processes that involve a unity of opposites. And despite what you're talking, and Engels talks about the creation and resolution of contradictions in processes, in time. I think this is important. Despite what you're taught in formal logic, contradictions aren't always bad or impossible. They're often what produces movement and change, which formal logic isn't meant to capture. And grasping this is necessary in order to understand processes that go from one thing to its opposite. Processes without dialectical logic would seem impossible or miraculous or something. Consider, this is a simple example, whether a person is hungry midway through eating a meal that takes like 20 minutes, right? I thought this was like in Plato, but I couldn't find it. Some ancient philosophers talked about this. So, is the person hungry midway through the meal? On the one hand, yes, of course, because they continue eating for another 10 minutes. But at the same time, no, since being hungry is about not having eaten, and they've been eating for 10 minutes already, right? So this example, I think, helps show that dialectics can make sense of things that would otherwise be mysterious. If you consider things in isolation and still, instead of connected and in motion, it rubs your brain the wrong way to say that a person is hungry and not hungry, right? It's like, which is it? But if you consider that eating is a process that takes time, during which you go from being completely hungry to completely full, or maybe a little past that, and are a little of both at all times in between, there's nothing odd in such a contradiction or the fact that eating both embodies and resolves it. The person is hungry and not hungry because they're in the middle of eating, right? Again, this is not, none of that should be a surprise to anybody. Again, this is what, I mean, dialectics, it's part of how I think we all already think, maybe unconsciously. One political upshot of this is that struggles to transform the world, as Rosa Luxemburg explained so well, have to begin with struggles that will not, by themselves, do that. And whether you can appreciate this or not, I think has major implications, right? So consider the struggle for marriage equality a few years ago, which, as you probably know, some on the left denigrated on the grounds that marriage itself is historically oppressive, and so on. In short, not radical, not revolutionary, but those people said, we are radical and revolutionary, so no thanks, you know? Don't want to contradict what we're about, that would be nonsense. But beyond the absurdity, right, of standing aloof from a struggle that brings material benefits to people excluded from them on bigoted grounds, the point here is that revolutionary struggles don't just pop up instantaneously just as radical as they need to be. They have to be built up from ones that are limited, but through which people come to a sharper understanding of the conditions of their liberation and are emboldened to continue to organize and fight for more. Right? This means that revolutionary struggle necessarily begins with struggles that are not revolutionary. And again, if you look at things as a kind of still life, isolated and fixed, you won't appreciate that this is a contradiction that can only be resolved and has to be resolved in practice and over time, and will end up standing aloof from things that you should be involved in, right? Likewise, when you look at things as isolated and fixed, you aren't able to see the contradictions that are embedded in reality. You look at capitalism, you see workers working over here, capitalists accumulating profits over there. Two different things, they might be connected, but they're not contradictory. It's only when you look at things in motion that you see workers getting poorer and their situation more precarious the more profits they produce, and capitalists needing to exploit and oppress workers in order to compete with one another and accumulate. You start to notice that capitalism consists of two classes that have conflicting interests that can't be resolved in a way that preserves capitalism. That over time, capitalism destroys the very things it needs, from working people to the environment. That as a result of this process, it produces economic and political conflict that it can't resolve. As the Marxist playwright Bertolt Brecht put it, because things are the way they are, they will not remain the way they are. Right? Which I think is extremely profound, right? If you let this, if the world will change, it will become what it is not because of how it is. right? Things may not necessarily get better without our intervention, of course, but they can't stay this way, and not because someday a meteor is going to hit, but because they're unstable and unsustainable in themselves. Right? Reality contains contradictions, right? Things that are a unity of opposites, processes in which things develop and transform, often into their opposites, because of how they're constituted, because of what they are. Speaking of that, recently a comrade and I were at a bar after a meeting, and down the table from us, some people were playing Jenga. Yes, Jenga. The tower suddenly fell, and because we're nerds, thank you, we said quantity into quality, right? Which is true. A second law of dialectics, beyond the unity of opposites, is the fact that an accumulation of quantitative changes, right, in other words, the successive addition or subtraction of a quantity of something, at a certain point, depending on the particulars of the case, creates a qualitative change. Right? This is not surprising, given that reality develops by way of contradictions. And even Jenga embodies a contradiction. The game consists in each player taking out a block and loading it on top as if it's going to be indefinitely, but this obviously can't be done indefinitely. The tower can't withstand that action forever. The principle of play is unsustainable. That's the whole point of the game. You want to be the last person to do that before it falls, right? So during the game, each move builds the tower up, and at a certain point, just relocating yet one more block, the very thing you've been doing the whole time, turns it from a standing squared off tower into a pile with some of them on the floor. When it falls, under normal conditions, like no one bumped the table, what makes it fall is just one more instance of the very same move that defines the game, nothing else, right? It's like the straw that broke the camel's back. Again, that's quantity and equality. In Capital, after Marx discusses the fact that money has to be accumulated up to a certain point before it can function as invested capital, right? I can't just do that with the $5 or whatever in my pocket, he says, here, as in natural science, is shown the correctness of the law discovered by Hegel in his Logic that merely quantitative changes beyond a certain point pass into qualitative differences. Speaking of nature, I and many others in the room, we live in Portland, which is in a subduction zone, which you may have heard, where the Juan de Fuca plate pushes up against and under the North American plate. This movement has, however, been stuck for a long time, building pressure gradually. At some point, however, this pressure will cause the plates to become unstuck and will produce one hell of a qualitative change in the form of a monster earthquake, which we're all looking forward to. A lot. Likewise, you know, qualitative change in the climate that we're experiencing has been created by the quantitative addition of more and more carbon into the atmosphere, and the fact, this is important, you have to understand things in context, the fact that the ecosystem can't withstand such increases indefinitely without triggering, to put it very mildly, qualitative changes. A sense of the organizational relevance of this law is found in Anti-During, where Engels cites Napoleon, of all people, describing, as he says, the combat between the French cavalry, who were bad riders but disciplined, had organization, and the Mamluks, who were undoubtedly the best horsemen of their time for single combat but lacked discipline, right? And Napoleon says, and try to pay attention to the numbers if you can, two Mamluks were undoubtedly more than a match for three Frenchmen. 100 Mamluks were equal to 100 Frenchmen. 300 Frenchmen could generally beat 300 Mamluks, and 1,000 Frenchmen invariably defeated 1,500 Mamluks. So the question of who had the upper hand, right, which is a qualitative difference that means victory or defeat, varied considerably, and yet the difference was ultimately a function of the numbers. As Engels explains, a detachment of French cavalry had to be of a definite minimum number in order to make it possible for the force of discipline, which makes no difference in smaller numbers, to manifest itself and rise superior even to greater numbers of irregular cavalry, in spite of the latter being better horsemen and fighters. Right? So just like everything else in dialectics, this has to be understood in context. The point isn't that greater numbers just makes a qualitative change magically happen, but rather, as Engels says in his explanation, the qualitative advantage of greater discipline and organization can only make a difference in reality when the quantity of troops reaches a certain point. So bringing this up to today, when we mobilize against the far right, not on horseback, of course, not yet anyway, that'd be cool, we emphasize numbers, no, actually it wouldn't be because I can't write it, anyway, we emphasize numbers, as close as we could get to a mass mobilization. But this isn't just because more is better in the abstract, right? It's because we don't want to just have a street fight or just take them on ourselves, which would play into their hands even if we win, and at best it would alienate those we want to embolden to join in the struggle, right? It's because we want to decisively show that they're a minority, to make it impossible for the media to do their whole both sides are bad bullshit, to demoralize them, make them look as ridiculous and out of touch as they are, and to build the potential for future struggles. These are deep qualitative differences in the result that we're trying to achieve, and it obviously requires a certain quantity of people, right? Now, looking at things in reverse, this point also applies in taking seriously the qualitative changes in the situation that can and will come if they're able to build numbers. That enters into it as well. And by the way, this law works the other way around as well, right? So qualitative changes, like, say, Trump being elected, can open up new possibilities for quantitative changes, like the growth of socialist organizations. It's not that simple, but I think that that applies. Now, the law of quantity and equality is one that explains how there can be leaps in material development, not just gradual or purely quantitative changes. In fact, qualitative leaps are to be expected. They're normal in a world that's made up of all kinds of interactivity, tensions, and contradictions. In fact, in The Science of Logic, Hegel makes fun of the idea that reality only contains gradual changes by showing that this makes total nonsense of one of the most basic aspects of the world, namely the fact that things come into being and pass away. He said, and this is so far the only place I've ever found where Hegel is funny, he says, underlying the doctrine of gradualness, right, just only gradual changes, is the conception that that which comes into being already exists in reality and remains unobserved only because of its small dimensions. Sorry, I thought that was funny. likewise, destruction or passing away would have to mean that the non-existence of the thing in question is an accomplished fact, even though, you know, you're looking right at it. This is an important background point for the discussion of the third law of dialectics, which is that reality contains not only qualitative changes built up out of quantitative ones, but a progression through stages in which a thing is transformed into something else, right? No longer what it was, but where the new, different thing depends on and would not be what it is if not for what came before, what it no longer is. Further, this process can be repeated, but instead of bringing us back to exactly where we started, we're brought to another new stage that itself depends on and carries with it elements of the entire previous process, even though previous stages are transformed out of existence in that process, right? So visually, we can think of this form of development more like a spiral than a circle. This law is called the negation of the negation. So to take a simple example used by Engels, the germination, a lot of people make fun of this because they think it's trite, but I think it's a great example. The germination of a barley seed brings forth a plant. The seed is negated. It fully ceases to exist. It's gone once the plant takes root and grows. But the plant would not exist if it hadn't been a seed, right? It is a plant because it was a seed, because of what it no longer is, because of what was negated in the process of bringing it into being. Further, when the plant itself is negated, in other words, dies, it leaves behind not one, but many seeds, right? Many seeds which, again, would not exist without the entire foregoing process, starting with the one seed. Now, obviously, there's more to it that biology can describe. There's DNA that encodes this process, which itself is the product of the whole history of this plant, including, I think, in this case, probably selective breeding. But in any case, it's a process involving not only qualitative but fully transformational changes, which nevertheless preserve something in previous stages while they're even though it negates them. The many seeds left at the end are not the result of the one seed like spontaneously multiplying. The plant that exists in between those stages is necessary for that to happen. Now, you might think that using the term negation here is a little bit overkill, right? That it suggests something more like grinding the seed into flour, just totally destroying it. But as Engels points out, this kind of negation, in other words, total annihilation, would make a second one, right, a further transformation that builds on it, impossible. As he says, negation in dialectics does not mean simply saying no or destroying something in any way you like. If I grind a grain of barley, I've negated it, but I've made any further transformation impossible. Interestingly enough, the book Anti-During itself is an example of this law and shows that it applies to intellectual development as well as material. It's basically, it's a primer on dialectical materialism. That is amazing, and it only came about because this guy Eugene Düring in Germany had made a name for himself, ever so briefly, by trying to theoretically annihilate Marxism. So we could think of Düring as a first negation, as like the anti-Marx. But since his theory ranged all over the place, from math to philosophy to economics and socialist theory, Engels' rebuttal couldn't help but turn out to be a more comprehensive exposition of dialectical materialism than had existed in one place prior to Dürer. So we can thank him for that, right? And I think that this example generalizes, right? You read a draft of a research paper to your peers, they ruthlessly critique it. You write a new draft that answers their critiques and so doesn't just reestablish but strengthens and deepens your original argument. Their critiques are negations of your argument. Your new draft builds on but also negates those critiques as critiques by incorporating answers to them moving forward. Your paper is something new and better than what you started with because of this whole process, including the sometimes painful first negation. Right? Or your feelings are hurt because everybody says all kinds of really good objections. So this dialectical law is about the kinds of changes, often major ones, that are possible given the fact that things develop through an accumulation of previous stages that are both transformed and carried forward into new stages. It's a specific application of the more general dialectical law that things and situations don't just emerge out of nowhere, but as a result of transformations of previous reality. As the biologist Stephen Jay Gould put it, the negation of the negation is about the direction given to history by the fact that complex systems cannot revert exactly to previous states. Now, the most frequently cited, I think, example of this law as it applies to human history comes from Volume 1 of Capital, where Marx discusses how the rise of capitalist production involved an elimination, or negation, if you like, of private property in the sense of the expropriation of the means of production held by a large number of small producers, their land, their tools, their workshops, and so forth. So private property and means of production was, of course, not annihilated, but it was fully transformed. It became gathered into the hands of a small number of much larger scale producers, ultimately leaving the smaller producers owning nothing but their labor power to sell to those larger producers. But think about this, right? Once that transformation has spread across the globe, what would another elimination of private property and means of production look like? We all know too well, right? Workers now form a mass of people who, as a result of capitalist development itself, that whole intervening process, now produce in unprecedented abundance. But they no longer own and can't take back means of production individually, or not on a mass scale anyway. Now the situation, and because of this, the situation is one in which another negation or elimination of private property would be totally different. It would mean putting a gigantic means of production into the collective hands of a mass of workers who can only hope to control it together if they control it at all. This is why Marx identifies the potential future conclusion of this process as one in which the expropriators are expropriated. Capturing perfectly the idea of a negated negation. Capitalism negated the small-scale property of many in favor of the large-scale property of a few. The coming socialist revolution will in turn negate that, but since property and means of production will have fundamentally changed in the meantime, the second negation won't just bring us back to where we started, but to something not only qualitatively different, but historically unprecedented. Now look, as we should know by now, this particular negated negation is not an inevitability. Marx's point here, as a materialist dialectician, is that it is also not a pipe dream. It may just be a possibility, but it is a real material possibility that has been brought about by the whole previous development of economic history. And this is actually my favorite part of dialectical materialism. It's a theory of optimism, right? Real optimism, not delusional. Capitalism can only keep up winning a streak by laying the ground for spectacular losses. Right? The worse it all looks from a narrow, undialectical perspective, the more intense the upswing will be once it gets going. Right? As we know, just look at the ferocity and contagiousness of the teacher strikes recently, many of them wildcat, after 40 years of neoliberalism, which itself is a negation of the New Deal. There's more to it, of course, but let's not give up in despair before we've started. Dialectics can help with that. I want to draw out the consequences of this point, that dialectical materialism sees the future as an open-ended set of material possibilities, not inevitabilities, for how I think we should understand the sense in which the laws of dialectics are laws. As I hope to have shown, they can be illustrated with any number of real-life examples. But there's a risk here that we come away thinking that they're just kinds of things that happen, even though that's true. Or as Lenin puts it, merely a sum total of examples, as he says, right? For example, a seed. For example, primitive communism. Instead of a law of development that furnishes the key to the self-movement of everything existing, right? To the destruction of the old and the emergence of the new. In other words, the reason why it's so easy to think of examples of these laws is because they get a handle on the way the world works. Things that are organized unsustainably will change. often abruptly, even if we have to look carefully at the details to have any sense of how and when and in what specific way. And even if sometimes we don't know precisely. Previous developments will be carried into the present and future with and without our help, even while being transformed. Now you might think that all you need to do is just look at the details or the particulars and not worry about any supposed laws of dialectics. But you need to have a sense of the way reality contains internal contradictions, a sense of how quantitative changes build towards qualitative ones, and how previous stages of development are transformed and carried forward into new ones to even know what details to pay attention to, right? To avoid just shooting in the dark. This is why, to those who insisted that dialectics was just a pointless game that should be set aside in favor of focusing on concrete political questions, Trotsky insisted that it is only by way of a clear theoretical method that concrete questions can find their proper place and proportion. The alternative, as he put it, is going from one day to the next, one incident to another, clinging to isolated phrases in an editorial, operating with disconnected observations and superficial generalizations, and ultimately, ironically enough, not having a solid approach to the concrete political questions you're in such a hurry to focus on. History becomes one random, inexplicable thing after another. Politics becomes transformed into a series of improvisations, and major events always come as a shock. Right. Now, it would be overkill to require every socialist to master, like, the science of logic or whatever. Dialectics, right, the capacity to understand things as living processes and not as disconnected, motionless facts, unfolding under the pressure of various forces that are themselves constantly changing, serves a revolutionary fighter, as Trotsky put it, in the way that that finger exercises serve a pianist. One lesson here is that philosophical and political orientations are connected. I don't think it's an accident that the group of Bolsheviks who turned away from materialism after 1905 in favor of the idealist view that we only really know our own ideas and perceptions were also voluntarists in politics, meaning that they thought that we could just build a world conforming to any ideas we have or change it in any way we like if we just try hard enough, right? And you can see the LeBlanc reference on your sheet for more on this. It's really good. It may not be a simple direct connection. I don't think we should say that we have this philosophical view and then it produces a political view. That would be idealism, and it's not that simple. But they're connected. I don't think it's a coincidence. I also don't think it's a coincidence that the comrades Trotsky criticized for laughing at dialectics, who thought it was hilarious that Trotsky cared so much about it, all wound up abandoning revolutionary socialism, one of them later becoming the editor of the National Review. Right? So I think we should take the idea of dialectical laws seriously. But at the same time, they aren't like the law of gravity or Boyle's law or whatever. They don't give you predictions that are mathematically precise and certain. You can't use dialectics to predict when quantitative changes will trigger a qualitative one the way you could predict an eclipse. This is another reason why philosophy is important, I think. If you do away with the kind of constant critical questioning that philosophy at its best instills, you might still be a dialectical materialist, but you'll end up wielding it as a rigid dogma. Right? One of the worst things that ever happened to dialectical materialism was when Joseph Stalin wrote a book called Dialectical Materialism, in which the transition from feudalism to capitalism and from capitalism to socialism was depicted as an accomplished fact, which in turn gave this, or was meant to give this, ready-made rationalization to every self-serving thing the bureaucracy did as an historical inevitability that you couldn't disagree with any more than you could disagree with gravity. Likewise, in Hegel's idealist version of dialectics, where the principle of change lies not in material reality but in ideas, even prior to the existence of material reality, contradictions always end up being resolved in the present state of things, in the status quo. That Marxist dialectics is materialist means that the present is not necessarily the end of things, definitely not the end of things, right? Our ideas and conceptions don't necessarily exhaust all of material reality, the future is open-ended, and that where there are gaps or places where the theory needs further elaboration or application to present reality, this will be filled in by actual struggle and the theoretical lessons and conclusions that activists draw from them. It also means, as Trotsky points out, that even dialectical materialism itself may someday be superseded by a more profound theory into which it will enter merely as structural material. One more lesson from Trotsky and I'll wrap up. Right? In recounting the early days of Russian Marxism and its newspaper Iskra, Trotsky recalls that many at the time wanted to engage in the concrete labor movement instead of wasting time on theory. As he puts it, the main argument was as follows. Iskra wants to found a school of dialectical materialism, whereas we want to overthrow czarism. It must be said that the Narodnik, or anarchist, terrorists took this very seriously. bomb in hand, they sacrificed their lives, while we argued that we should first try to clarify our minds. He saw this the Bolshevik approach as vindicated, as he put it, by the fact that the greatest revolution in all history was not led by the party that started out with bombs, but by the party that started out with dialectical materialism. In other words, even though my title is Dialectical Materialism for Activists, that's not quite right. Dialectical materialism is for nobody else but activists. And it's probably not surprising, when I was doing the research for this talk, I discovered that the ones who really accept and build this theory, who don't try to run away from the materialist side, or the dialectical side, or both, are in fact activists. And the ones who instead are in a hurry to discredit it, to reject all or part of it, are disengaged academics and professionals who don't take revolutionary socialism seriously, and therefore don't take seriously the need to orient their thinking towards the task of actually achieving a world that is both materially possible and increasingly necessary. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.